Welcome to the Federal News Update for Wednesday, November 12th, 2025. I'm Alex Johnson.
And I'm Sam Tennedy. It's great to be back.
And Sam, we are definitely sitting at a fascinating point right now. This feels like one of those deep dives where the immediate headline, the shutdown finally ending, well, it just barely scratches the surface.
Oh, absolutely. That's the immediate drama. But beneath it, there are these really significant, almost tectonic shifts happening across the federal government. Big strategic moves.
Exactly. And that's our mission today. We want to be exhaustive, really granular, digging into everything the U.S. federal government has been doing since, let's say, the start of November 11th.
Right. The nitty-gritty actions.
Yes. But then we want to synthesize that, connect the dots, show you, the listener, how these immediate things fit into the major deep policy pivots that are really defining this whole transition period, late 2025, moving into 2026.
So you'll walk away knowing not just what happened yesterday and today, but why it actually matters for the next year or so.
Precisely. So to grasp that bigger picture, that strategic pivot, we have to start with the immediate chaos, right? The core tension right now, November 11th, November 12th. It's all about the end, hopefully, of this staggering 42-day government shutdown.
It's hard to even fathom. 42 days. And the House is coming back today, Wednesday the 12th. They haven't been in session since, September 19th? Nearly 8 weeks?
8 weeks. In legislative time, that's an ice age, especially when you think about the damage, the operational mess, the economic hit from a 6-week funding gap. It's huge.
And Speaker Mike Johnson, he's recalling everyone but the math. Well, the math is just brutal for him. He's got this razor-thin Republican majority.
So the vote today on the Senate spending package, it's really hanging by a thread. It could come down to just a handful of people switching sides, couldn't it? Either Republicans or Democrats.
Oh, absolutely. On the Republican side, you've got folks like Thomas Massie, right? The real fiscal hardliners who've basically said they'll vote no on anything that doesn't have major structural reforms, shutdown or no shutdown.
And on the Democratic side?
Well, you've got your key centrists, people like Jared Golden, Henry Kweller, maybe, and then some progressives like Marie Glusenkamp-Perez. They're all kind of wild cards, depending on what they see as wins or losses for their own districts or priorities. The outcome's genuinely uncertain.
Which make the details of this Senate deal absolutely critical. This isn't just about reopening the government. It's about what got traded away. Let's really dive into the guts of this resolution.
Okay, so the Senate passed this thing 60-40 on Monday, November 10th. And the first thing to understand is it's a hybrid package.
Yeah.
That's really important. It doesn't treat the whole government the same way.
Hybrid meaning some parts get long-term funding, others just a short leash.
Exactly. Four specific areas got funded long-term right through the end of fiscal year 2026. So that's until September 30th, 2026. Gives them real certainty.
Okay, who were the lucky four?
Military construction, Veterans Affairs, that's a big one, the Department of Agriculture, and maybe tellingly the legislative branch itself. Congress made sure its own lights stay on.
Funny how that works. But what about everyone else? The vast majority of the government?
That's where the short leash comes in. The rest is funded by a continuing resolution, a CR, and it only runs until January 30th.
January 30th. So barely avoiding this crisis just sets us up for another massive budget battle in, less than 80 days, right at the start of the new year?
Pretty much. We've kicked the can, but not very far down the road. At least, veterans care and some national security functions got that longer-term stability.
Still, it feels like a temporary fix for most agencies. Now, getting this deal even this far required some serious concessions, especially around the federal workforce, right? They were hit hard by this shutdown.
Oh, incredibly hard. And Senate Democrats dug in their heels on workforce protections. It was key to getting their votes.
So what did they manage to secure for the employees? Because stabilizing that workforce, the career staff, that's essential for anything else the government wants to do.
Two main things. First, crucially, full back pay for every single federal employee who missed paychecks. And remember, many missed two full pay cycles. That's devastating for families.
That's basic fairness, really. What was the second part?
This one's maybe even more significant structurally. The deal compels agencies to reverse all the reduction in force actions, the RIFs, that happened since the shutdown started.
Ah, the layoffs. There were notices going out, weren't there?
Yeah. Back in mid-October, the White House had basically told agencies to start preparing for layoffs. About 1,400 employees actually got those RIF notices. This deal forces agencies to pull all of those back.
Wow. Okay, that's a big deal. It's basically saying you can't use this shutdown chaos as cover to gut departments. It sends a message to the career staff that their jobs aren't just political pawns.
It was absolutely non-negotiable for the Senate Democrats. You've heard people like Marcus Hill from the Senior Executives Association talking about how vital this is for just, well, continuity of government. You lose that expertise, especially in specialized fields like cyber engineering. It takes years, maybe decades, to rebuild.
But, you know, deals always involve trade-offs. There's always a cost. And it sounds like the Democrats paid a pretty steep price on the healthcare front to get those workforce protections, the ACA subsidies.
Yeah, this is where the deal gets really painful for Democrats and where you're seeing all the internal party fighting flare up now. The huge concession, the one that's causing fury, is that the bill explicitly excludes an extension for the enhanced Affordable Care Act subsidies.
And those expire when? End of the year.
End of this year, December 31st. It's a massive cliff. And what did Senate Republicans offer instead? Basically nothing. They just agreed to hold a vote on extending the subsidies later. No promise it would pass, just a vote.
Wait a minute. Just a vote, not a guarantee. Why on earth would Democratic leadership accept that, knowing millions of people could see huge premium hikes in just a few weeks?
Politics. Pure and simple. The overwhelming pressure to reopen the government now. The fear of being blamed for letting the shutdown drag on past, you know, day 42, day 45, jeopardizing VA care even more, making the airport chaos worse. It seems that short-term pressure just outweighed the long-term policy goal for them.
So they traded reopening the government now for basically abandoning a core piece of their healthcare platform, at least for the moment.
That's how many progressives see it. And that difference between a guaranteed extension and just a promise of a future vote, it's everything. We're talking, what, 22 million people facing potentially massive premium increases? Some estimates say premiums could triple for older folks in certain states if those credits expire. It's a policy disaster waiting to happen.
And from the Republican side, Speaker Johnson must see this as a complete victory.
Oh, he basically said as much. He said something like, what we're voting on is pretty much exactly what we offered them weeks ago. From their perspective, the Democrats blinked. They held the line and won.
Okay. Let's talk about the immediate real-world impacts of this 42-day shutdown that forced this deal.
Mm-hmm.
Transportation, especially air travel, seemed to be where people felt it most directly.
It was becoming a nightmare. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy was out there warning very publicly that if this thing went on any longer, we'd see massively more disruption. Think about it. The FAA had already cut flights by 6% at 40 major airports. Why? Not enough air traffic controllers showing up to work because they weren't getting paid.
6%. And that was already causing delays and cancellations.
Right. And Duffy said it was on track to hit 8%, maybe 10%, if the shutdown continued. The system was fraying fast.
And then you had the rhetoric, the controversy around how the administration was talking about the controllers themselves.
Yeah, that really blew up. President Trump's post on Truth Social threatening to substantially dock the pay of controllers who missed work, and at the same time offering $10,000 bonuses to the ones who did show up, calling them great patriots.
Implying those who couldn't come in, for whatever reason, weren't patriotic. That seems incredibly unfair to people working a high-stress job without pay.
It caused huge outrage, especially from the unions. Sarah Nelson, the head of the flight attendants union, she called the comments disgraceful. She made the point, these aren't machines, they're human beings. Maybe they had a family emergency, maybe they were dealing with cancer treatment, maybe they literally couldn't afford the gas to get to work after missing paychecks. She said they acted heroically through the shutdown, and that kind of talk was just a deliberate political attack.
And Secretary Duffy, he had to deal with the operational fallout, right?
Yeah.
Even if the government reopens today, the problems don't just vanish overnight.
No, not at all. He basically acknowledged that controllers who maybe found temporary work or are still dealing with a financial mess from the shutdown, they might not just flood back immediately. So the flight cuts, the delays, that disruption could linger for weeks, even with the funding turned back on.
That's the hidden cost, isn't it? It's not just stopping work, it's breaking the system, breaking morale. Rebuilding that takes time.
Exactly. That damage lives on in air travel, as Duffy put it. It's a long road back to normal operations.
Okay, let's shift to an agency that actually did get some real stability out of this deal. Veterans Affairs. They got long-term funding and some important structural protections.
This was definitely a priority, and you saw bipartisan support for insulating the VA. The Senate deal gives them $133 billion in discretionary funds for FY 2026. That's a decent bump, about 3% over the previous year.
But it wasn't just about the money, was it? There were strings attached regarding staffing.
Crucially, yes. The deal includes mandated staffing targets. This directly pushes back against the VA's own earlier plans, floated during the budget process, to potentially cut up to 30,000 positions, mostly through attrition, as part of some reorganization effort.
30,000 positions? That sounds huge. Weren't frontline clinical staff included in that?
That was the fear. The initial numbers suggested maybe 20,000 clinical staff, including nurses at the Veterans Health Administration, could have been affected. So Congress stepped in very specifically.
How specifically? What did the bill mandate for veteran care?
They got really granular. The bill sets actual metrics. Veterans shouldn't wait longer than 20 days for primary care or mental health appointments. For specialty care, the target is no more than 28 days. And the Benefits Administration, they have a target of processing claims within 125 days. These are hard targets written into law.
That's significant pressure. And they also singled out the Veterans Crisis Line for protection.
Yes, absolutely. There is real worry that cost-cutting might hit the VCL, so the bill flat-out prohibits reducing staff or services there, and it demands constant reporting from the VA on staffing levels, call answer rates, wait times, basically full transparency to make sure that Lifeline stays fully operational.
Beyond the immediate staffing and services, the deal also addresses the VA's long-running saga with its electronic health record system, the EHR rollout. That's been a mess.
A hugely expensive mess. So the deal allocates $3.4 billion to restart the EHR rollout. But, and this is a big, Congress put some serious brakes on it, they're withholding 30% of that money, a huge chunk, until July 2026.
What triggers the release of that withheld money?
Proof of success. The VA has to certify 4 consecutive successful site deployments of the new EHR system. And successful means no patient harm caused by the system and no significant delays in care delivery during the rollout at those sites.
4 consecutive successes with no harm. That sounds like Congress has zero trust left in the program's management after all the previous problems.
You got it. It's basically saying, show us it works consistently, safely, before you get the rest of the money. No more blank checks based on promises. They also demanded a full updated cost estimate for the whole project and a site-by-site deployment schedule. Much more transparency than before the pause in 2023.
Okay, let's pull back from the immediate deal mechanics and look at the wider political landscape swirling around all this around November 11th and 12th. The fallout from that ACA subsidy decision is already hitting the Democratic Party hard.
Oh, it's brutal. Open warfare, basically. Progressives are absolutely furious. You've got Bernie Sanders, Ro Khanna in the House. They're using words like surrender. They feel the leadership just folded after 41 days, right when they thought they had maximum leverage.
And that anger is being directed straight at the top, at Senate leader Chuck Schumer.
Very much so. You're hearing whispers, well, more than whispers now, from colleagues calling it weak leadership. Sanders openly questioned who might replace Schumer, saying he's part of the establishment, and maybe not the fighter the party needs right now.
Even Fetterman chimed in.
Yeah, Senator Fetterman, who actually voted for the deal, one of only 8 Democrats who did, he kind of mused aloud that no one really knows who's actually running the party in D.C. right now. That speaks volumes about the perceived leadership vacuum.
And into that vacuum steps.
Mm-hmm.
Governor Gavin Newsom.
Like clockwork, Newsom saw the opening and just pounced. He went public immediately, calling the Democratic cave-in pathetic, blasting them for rolling over on the ACA. It was pure political opportunism, perfectly timed.
And perfectly positioned for his 2028 ambitions.
Absolutely. He's using this to cement his image as the fighter, the guy who's willing to take on Trump aggressively, contrasting himself directly with what's perceived as weakness in DC leadership. He's reminding everyone of his win with Prop 50 redistricting in California, basically saying, see, I know how to fight and win.
He's basically auditioning for the role of Democratic Trump Slayer that the base seems to be craving.
That's exactly the play. The base wants a fighter. Newsom's throwing punches, even coining nicknames like the Nod Father for Trump. It's grabbing attention, it's grabbing donations, and it makes him the unavoidable frontrunner for 2028 right now.
Cool. While all this shutdown drama was unfolding, another big piece of legislation was quietly moving. The National Defense Authorization Act. The NDAA for FY 2026. And there's a major fight brewing within that bill over right to repair for military gear.
Yeah, this is a really interesting, long simmering battle. It pits the military's need for cheaper, faster repairs and better readiness against the defense industry's desire to protect its intellectual property and, well, its very profitable repair monopolies.
And Senator Elizabeth Warren is leading the charge for reform.
She is. She's been very vocal, accusing the big defense lobby, the National Defense Industrial Association, NDIA, of basically blocking common sense reforms. She calls their arguments dangerous and misguided, aimed at protecting unacceptable status quo of giant contractor profiteering. Strong words.
Does the military have concrete examples of why this is such a problem?
Oh, they have shocking examples. The Army Secretary, Dan Driscoll, he highlighted one that just sounds absurd. A tiny screen control knob breaks on a Black Hawk helicopter. It's probably a $15 part. But the manufacturer won't sell just the knob. They force the Army to buy the entire integrated screen assembly for $47,000.
$47,000 for a broken knob.
Exactly. Driscoll said the Army could probably make the knob themselves if they just had the technical data, the schematics. That one example represents potentially millions wasted across the force, not to mention helicopters being grounded waiting for overpriced parts.
So what are the solutions being proposed in Congress? I understand the House and Senate have slightly different takes in their versions of the NDAA.
They do. The House approach is more about getting data access up front. Their provision is called Data as a Service Solutions for Weapon System Contracts. It basically requires DOD to negotiate access to essential technical data, software details, digital models, before they even sign the main contract to buy the weapon system.
So embedding data rights from the very beginning, what's the Senate's approach?
The Senate version focuses more on the maintenance side, after the equipment is delivered. It requires contractors to provide something called Instructions for Continued Operational Readiness, or ICOR. Think of ICOR as really detailed repair manuals and schematics that the military needs to do its own maintenance and sustainment.
Okay. House wants data up front. Senate wants detailed manuals after. How is the industry, the NDIA, pushing back against both of these?
Their core argument is intellectual property protection. They claim both approaches, especially the House's data as a service idea, threaten their proprietary designs and software. They worry that if DOD gets all this data, it could leak to competitors, maybe smaller repair shops, undermining their business model. They argue it would hamper innovation and scare off cutting-edge companies from working with the DOD.
But the counterargument from people like Warren is that opening up the repair market would actually boost innovation and help smaller businesses.
Exactly. It's a fundamental disagreement about how competition works in the defense sector. And it seems like military leadership is increasingly siding with the reformers. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth apparently told the Army back in April to start building right-to-repair language into all new contracts, focusing on schedule, performance, and cost, implicitly deprioritizing the manufacturer's IP concerns when they hinder readiness or drive up costs.
Okay, let's swing back to domestic policy. The Trump administration seems to be wrestling with this issue of affordability. Voters are clearly worried, even if the president himself sounds dismissive.
That's the core tension, isn't it? You have polls like the one in Virginia showing nearly half of voters citing the economy and cost of living as their top issue. But then you have President Trump on the stump saying, you know, greatest economy ever, and calling affordability concerns a con job by the Democrats.
But the actions suggest they know it's a political vulnerability. They are doing things.
They are taking some very specific targeted actions. First, the president directed the Justice Department to launch an investigation into the big meatpacking companies. He's alleging illicit collusion, price fixing, and price manipulation.
Why meatpackers specifically?
Beef prices, they're up something like 15% over the past year. So this allows the administration to point a finger at a specific industry and say, see, they're the ones gouging you, rather than addressing broader inflation concerns.
Okay, targeted blame. What's the second initiative? The one getting a lot more buzz.
That's the proposal for a 50-year mortgage. This is being pushed by the FHFA director, Bill Pult, as a potential game changer for housing affordability, especially aimed at younger buyers priced out of the market.
The idea being stretch the loan term way out and the monthly payments come down.
That's the pitch. Lower monthly payments make it easier to qualify and afford a home.
Let's really break down the numbers here for listeners because the trade-off seems significant.
It is. Let's take a simple example. Say a $200,000 loan. On a 50-year mortgage, yeah, your monthly payment might be around $1,275. Compare that to a standard 30-year mortgage, maybe $4,411 a month. So you save about $135 a month.
Okay, $135 a month sounds helpful if your budget is tight.
Yeah.
But what's the catch? The total interest paid.
That's where it gets eye-watering. On that $200,000 loan over 30 years, you'd pay roughly $126,000 in interest total. Over 50 years, you pay over $262,000 in interest, more than double. You're paying way more than the house's initial value just in interest.
Wow. So it's not really making housing more affordable in the long run. It's just making the monthly payment appear lower while trapping people in debt for half a century.
That's exactly the criticism. It doesn't fix the underlying problems, not enough houses being built, restrictive zoning, high material costs, maybe linked to trade policies. Critics see it as a financial gimmick, creating a generation of homeowners who build equity incredibly slowly and are basically locked into paying the bank for 50 years.
It feels like a marketing solution almost. Addressing the feeling of unaffordability for an election cycle rather than the structural problem.
That's a fair assessment. It allows the administration to say, we're doing something about housing because homeownership is such a core part of the American dream, especially for younger generations feeling shut out. The optics look good, smaller payments, even if the financial reality for the borrower is much harsher long term. It's marketing affordability, maybe not achieving it.
Okay, let's make that major shift now. We've covered the immediate storm, the shutdown ending, the legislative fights happening right now in November 2025. Now let's pull the lens back and focus on the bigger picture you mentioned earlier. The macro policy pivot, the really deep strategic changes shaping governance from late 2025 into mid-2026. This is where the underlying story emerges.
Right. This is where we move beyond the daily headlines. The research report we looked at identifies this rapid, really coherent, system-wide pivot across the government. And the unifying theme, the grand strategy, seems to be securitization.
Securitization, meaning elevating national security, technological security, above almost everything else.
Precisely. And the report breaks down how this pivot happened through three dominant macro-level trends.
Remind us what those three were again.
First, the lame duck pivot, where the outgoing administration leads some clever regulatory traps. Second, the regulatory and legislative nexus, showing how the new administration and Congress worked in tandem very quickly on things like AI and defense. And third, monetary fiscal policy divergence, which is creating this weird two-track American economy we're seeing now.
Got it. Let's start with the executive branch moves. Tell us about that lame duck action, Executive Order 14499. You called it the strategic trap. What did it do?
So on the surface, this EO signed in December 2025, right before the transition, looked like straightforward environmental policy. It basically told federal procurement agencies they had to apply a climate risk score to their main contractors.
So if a company had a big carbon footprint or bad climate plans, they'd lose out on government contracts.
That was the idea. But the analysis suggests the real goal wasn't for this EO to actually last at the federal level.
How so? Why issue it then?
It was designed, quite cynically, to be overturned. The outgoing administration knew it was vulnerable to the Congressional Review Act, the CRA, which lets Congress quickly kill regulations issued late in a term. They wanted the incoming administration to have to use the CRA, spend political capital, spend valuable time fighting this thing right out of the gate.
So the fight itself was the goal, allowing them to frame the new administration as anti-environment for overturning it.
Their time and gives the outgoing party a political weapon. See? They're rolling back climate action.
Clever. But did it have any lasting impact if it got overturned federally?
Yes, and this is the really insidious part. It achieved its policy goal indirectly. The EO was carefully constructed using existing federal green contracting language and standards. It essentially created a ready-made, legally vetted template. So even when the federal rule was killed, environmental groups and friendly state governments could immediately pick up this template and push for similar climate risk score rules at the state and city level.
So it led to a patchwork of regulations across the country.
Precisely. A balkanized regulatory landscape, as the report calls it. More compliance headaches for businesses operating nationwide. The policy goal was achieved at the state level, even though the federal rule died. It was a very sophisticated play.
A masterclass in using lame duck power. Okay, now contrast that trap with the new administration's first big move, EO 1.501 on AI governance, signed in January 2026.
EO 1.501, this is really the foundation stone of the new securitization doctrine. It did one big thing. It created a brand new, very powerful, centralized task force on AI governance and national security.
Tasked with unifying how the government handles AI development, buying AI, controlling AI exports.
All of it.
All of it.
All of it, but the key, the real signal, is who leads this task force.
Who is it?
It's co-chaired by the Secretary of Defense, the Secretary of Commerce, and critically, the Director of National Intelligence, the DNI.
The DNI. So the head of the entire intelligence community is co-chairing a task force on AI governance.
Exactly. That structure is a massive statement. It officially reclassifies AI governance. It takes it out of the realm of purely commercial standards, which is where NIST, part of Commerce, traditionally led, and plants it firmly in the national security and geopolitical domain.
What does that mean in practical terms, giving the intelligence community a leading role in domestic tech policy?
It's a huge shift in power and perspective. It means decisions about AI development, deployment, even domestic use cases are now viewed primarily through a security lens. This EO kicked off a 90-day regulatory sprint for agencies, especially DOD and the intel community, to figure out all their AI uses. And it gave the executive branch the justification it needed to start imposing much stricter export controls and scrutinizing foreign investment in U.S. AI companies, prioritizing national security over purely commercial arguments.
Okay, so that executive order set the stage. Then Congress came in and basically wrote it into law. Tell us about the AI Governance and National Security Act of 2026, passed in May 26.
This law is the legislative anchor for the whole strategy. Hugely consequential. It rests on three main pillars. First, money, a lot of money, $50 billion over 5 years to create something called the National AI Research Reserve, or NARR. Think of it as a big government-controlled, secure sandbox for AI research.
$50 billion. Okay, what's the second pillar? You mentioned liability earlier.
This might be the most transformative part for the industry. It establishes a new, very strict liability framework specifically for what it calls critical impact AI.
And how is critical impact AI defined?
Very broadly, it covers AI used in sensitive areas. Medicine, running critical infrastructure like power grids, financial trading algorithms, defense systems, autonomous vehicles. Basically, anywhere an AI failure could cause significant harm.
In strict liability means?
It means if an AI system in one of those critical categories fails or causes harm, the company that developed or deployed it is held legally responsible, period. It doesn't matter if they were negligent or intended harm. If the AI messes up, they are liable for the damages. No excuses.
Wow. That sounds like it would make companies extremely cautious. What's the third pillar?
Export controls. The act basically writes into law a prohibition by default system for exporting advanced AI models, the algorithms themselves, and the high-end chips needed to run them. The new task force manages this. Essentially, unless an export is specifically greenlit, probably only to very close allies, it's banned.
Let's focus on that strict liability piece. What does that do to the AI market, especially things like open source AI development?
Functionally. It kills the open source AI era as we knew it in the U.S., at least for anything touching those critical sectors. Why? Because the risk is just too high for smaller players.
How so?
Think about it. If you're a startup or a university lab releasing open source code, can you afford the massive specialized insurance policies you'd need to cover potentially catastrophic failures under a strict liability regime? Can you afford the legal teams to handle the inevitable lawsuits? Probably not. The risk of being wiped out by a single lawsuit is enormous.
So the compliance costs, the insurance costs, the legal risk.
Yeah.
It all pushes development towards the biggest companies.
Exactly. It creates an immense barrier to entry. Only the giants, your Googles, Microsofts, Amazons, maybe the big defense contractors, have the deep pockets and the armies of lawyers to navigate this landscape.
Mm.
It forces consolidation. It creates government-favored national champions. It shifts AI development from a somewhat decentralized open field to a highly centralized, security-focused oligopoly.
Okay, so we have this massive new strategy, billions in funding for AI and defense. How do they pay for it? That brings us to the big spending bill, the Consolidated Appropriations Act 2026, passed in March 26.
Right, the omnibus spending bill. This was the vehicle to fund the new priorities. It included that big 10% hike in the base defense budget we talked about, and it provided the first big chunk of money for the $50 billion AI Act. There was broad agreement on funding those things.
Look, there had to be a political trade-off somewhere to get the votes right. What was the pay for?
The pay for was a direct hit on the Internal Revenue Service, the IRS. To get the necessary coalition, particularly appeasing fiscal conservatives, the deal included a rescission, a clawback of about $80 billion in multi-year funding that had previously been allocated to the IRS.
$80 billion taken away from the IRS. That funding was supposed to be for modernization and catching tax cheats, wasn't it?
Exactly. It was earmarked specifically for upgrading ancient IT systems and, crucially, hiring specialized auditors capable of handling complex audits of large corporations and high-net-worth individuals' areas where the tax gap is largest.
And didn't the Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, say that original funding would actually reduce the deficit over time?
It did. The CBO projected that investing that $80 billion in the IRS would yield more than $100 billion in new revenue over 10 years, simply by collecting taxes that are legally owed but currently go unpaid. So clawing back that money wasn't just a political compromise. It was, according to the CBO's analysis, a fiscally damaging choice. It increased the long-term deficit for short-term political gain.
Okay, these policy choices, funding security, cutting IRS enforcement, they feed directly into the bigger economic picture. You mentioned this two-track economy driven by a split between monetary and fiscal policy. Unpack that for us.
This is probably the most significant underlying tension in the economy right now. On one hand, you have the Federal Reserve running contractionary monetary policy. They're keeping interest rates relatively high to fight inflation.
And they did something else too, right? With bank capital requirements?
Yes. Crucially, in March 2026, the Fed increased the Tier 1 capital requirements for large banks.
Okay, what does Tier 1 capital mean, and why does raising the requirement matter?
Tier 1 capital is basically a bank's core safety cushion, its highest quality assets, like cash, retained earnings. When the Fed forces big banks to hold more of this safe capital as a percentage of their assets, it means those banks have less money available to lend out into the economy. It's another way the Fed tries to cool things down by restricting the flow of credit.
So the Fed is hitting the brakes, high rates, tighter lending from big banks, but fiscal policy government spending is hitting the accelerator.
Exactly. You've got this massive expansionary fiscal policy running at the same time. Billions pouring into the AI Act, the big defense budget increase, subsidies for critical minerals, maybe, huge government spending. These two forces are pulling in opposite directions.
And that collision creates the two tracks.
Yes, it bifurcates the economy. Track one is the national security economy. Think AI research labs funded by NAIR, defense contractors building new systems, companies mining or processing critical minerals with government support. This sector is booming, fueled by government money.
And it doesn't really care about high interest rates.
Not nearly as much. If you've got a guaranteed multi-billion dollar government contract, the Fed funds rate is secondary. Your growth is subsidized, insulated.
Okay, so that's track one. What's track two?
Track two is the traditional Main Street economy. Regional banks, regular manufacturing, construction companies, small businesses, consumer services. This sector relies on traditional bank lending, on capital flowing freely, and it's getting squeezed hard.
By the high interest rates and the tighter lending from the big banks.
Exactly. It's capital starved. Growth is sluggish. It feels the full force of the Fed's contractionary policy. So you get this weird situation, a high growth, subsidized, potentially inflationary national security sector floating alongside a low growth, capital constrained Main Street sector that might be flirting with stagnation or recession.
Which means the Fed's main tool, interest rates, is becoming kind of blunt. It only really hurts half the economy.
That's the danger. Raising rates clobbers Main Street, but it doesn't do much to cool inflation in the subsidized security sector because that sector isn't sensitive to rates in the same way. So the Fed might end up causing a recession on Main Street without actually taming inflation overall, especially in those priority sectors. It's a real policy dilemma.
And on the geopolitical front, this all ties into a clear doctrine of technological containment aimed primarily at China.
Yes, the strategy became very explicit with the signing of the Manila Compact in June 2026. This was a treaty between the U.S. and key allies, mostly in the Indo-Pacific,
And its purpose was.
to create a secure supply chain, a kind of cartel, for critical minerals, the rare earths, lithium, cobalt, etc., that are essential for batteries, semiconductors, all the advanced tech. It's explicitly designed to break China's current dominance in processing and supplying these materials. It's friendshoring, codified into a treaty.
How do they enforce it? Just agreeing isn't enough.
The enforcement is built around creating a clear in-group and out-group. If you're a company and you play by the rules, meaning you source your critical minerals only from within the compact's approved secure network of countries, you get benefits. Government financing, help with exports, priority access to lucrative federal contracts, especially from DOD and the Department of Energy.
So, carrots for playing along. What are the sticks for companies that don't, if they keep buying from, say, China?
Big sticks. If you source from non-secure suppliers outside the compact, you risk being shut out. Denial of access to those major government contracts is the primary lever. Given how much the U.S. government buys, especially in tech and energy, this effectively forces global companies to choose sides. They have to remap their entire supply chains to stay in the in-group if they want access to the U.S. market and government business. It leverages federal purchasing power to enforce geopolitical alignment.
Okay, bringing it back down to the ground level, post-shutdown, how is this new reality impacting the federal workforce and agency operations beyond just the budget numbers? We talked about the hiring freeze earlier.
Yeah.
That's hitting specific talent pipelines hard, isn't it?
Oh, incredibly hard. The story of the CyberCorps scholars is just, it's a perfect example of the contradiction. You have the Office of Personnel Management, OPM, their director Scott Kupor saying publicly, bringing in top AI and cyber talent is critical to national security.
But at the same time.
At the same time, there's this government-wide hiring freeze imposed by the administration for political reasons, and it keeps getting extended indefinitely.
And the CyberCorps kids, they get huge scholarships promising to work for the government afterwards.
Exactly. They get their education paid for sometimes hundreds of thousands of dollars with the explicit promise of a federal job in cyber or AI waiting for them. But now, because of the freeze, those jobs aren't there. We heard from scholars who had tentative offers from places like CISA or DOD contractors like MITRE, revoked, just gone.
And they're on the hook.
Yeah.
If they don't find a qualifying government job within 18 months, they have to pay back the entire scholarship.
Yes, hundreds of thousands in debt, potentially ruining them financially after they train specifically for public service at the government's request. It's a disaster for them personally, and it's completely undercutting the stated goal of bringing in top talent. How can you say talent is critical and then do this to the pipeline?
It seems like a broad political mandate, the freeze, is just overriding specific vital needs. Is OPM doing anything?
They were slow to react, but now they're talking about a mass deferment, basically giving the graduates more time to find a qualifying job. But the students are still really worried because the only jobs seemingly available are in the administration's top political priorities, like immigration enforcement, not necessarily the high-tech cyber roles they trained for. It's a mess.
And this hits morale across the board, right? Not just new recruits. Think about veterans in the federal workforce.
That's a huge group. Nearly a quarter of federal civilian employees are veterans, about 700,000 people. They bring incredible skills from the military into vital civilian roles, often nonpartisan administrative or technical jobs.
And how are they feeling after the shutdown and seeing things like the IRS funding cut?
Disrespected. We heard from Gibson Jones. He's an Army vet, now president of an NTEU chapter at the IRS. He put it really well. He said, the constant threats, the layoffs during the shutdown, the missed paychecks, and then seeing Congress specifically target and defund your agency like they did with the IRS, it feels like a slap in the face. It suggests their service, now as nonpartisan public servants, is just politically disposable. Disrespecting the workforce is disrespecting the vets within it.
Let's look at regulatory actions, too. The EPA seems to have made a move that gives the administration a lot of power without needing Congress.
Yeah, this is a key example of using existing regulatory authority to drive policy. In April 2026, the EPA finalized a new rule significantly tightening the air quality standards, the NAAQS for fine particulate matter, PM2.5. They lowered the acceptable level down to 9.0 micrograms per cubic meter. That's a big drop.
What was their justification for going so low?
The public health, but with a new twist. They cited recent studies, data from HHS, linking long-term exposure to PM2.5, not just to lung and heart disease, but also to neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's or Parkinson's.
Linking air pollution to brain disease. That's powerful.
Very powerful. And by framing it as a broad public health issue based on complex medical data, it makes the rule harder to challenge legally. And strategically, it gives the administration a potent non-legislative tool.
How does tightening an air quality standard give them control over industry?
Because states have to comply with NAAQS. If the standard is super tight, like 9.0, it becomes much harder, sometimes impossible, for states to permit new industrial facilities, think factories, power plants, especially anything burning fossil fuels, particularly in areas already struggling with air quality. It forces existing industries to invest potentially billions in pollution controls. Essentially, it acts as a powerful brake on industrial development that the administration might see as conflicting with its climate or strategic goals, all done through regulation, no new law needed from Congress.
We also saw a leadership shuffle at the FDA around the time of the shutdown ending, didn't we?
Yes, early November 2025. the head of the Center for Drug Evaluation and Research, CDR, a guy named George Tidmarsh, resigned pretty suddenly. There were allegations of personal misconduct swirling.
And who replaced him?
They brought in Richard Pazdur. He's a real FDA veteran, 26 years at the agency, highly respected, especially for founding and leading the Oncology Center of Excellence. His appointment was seen as a move to bring stability back to CDR, which is obviously critical for drug approvals, especially now with the focus on medical countermeasures under that whole securitization strategy.
Okay, one last piece on agency function. As the government pours billions into AI via the new act, there's a fundamental technical challenge they need to overcome for it to actually work, right? This idea of a semantic layer.
Yes, this is super important, but often gets lost in the high-level policy talk. The report highlights this. If you want AI, especially these sophisticated agentic AI systems, to work effectively across government, you absolutely need what's called a semantic layer. Think of it as a translation layer for data.
A translation layer. Explain that a bit more. A digital twin of knowledge.
Kind of. Imagine different agencies, DOD, VA, Energy, they all track personnel readiness, right? But that term might mean something slightly different in each agency's database. One might mean available for deployment, another medically up to date, a third certified on specific equipment. They use different labels, different definitions. And AI, just looking at the raw data, gets confused.
But the semantic layer connects those dots.
Exactly. It understands that DoD's Deployment Status Code 1 is contextually similar to the VA's clinical training completed field for certain kinds of analysis. It creates a unified understanding, a common language, mapping out the relationships and context across all these different data silos. It's the essential plumbing for making sense of disparate government data at scale.
And without that plumbing, the aid investments could just fail.
That's the huge risk. An MIT study found something like only 5% of enterprise AI projects actually deliver measurable value. Why? Often because they skipped this hard foundational work of data governance and building that contextual understanding, that semantic layer. If agencies just throw fancy AI models at messy, untranslated data, the results will likely be unreliable, brittle, and ultimately a massive waste of taxpayer money. The success of the whole AI strategy really hinges on getting this data infrastructure right.
Wow. Okay. This has been an incredibly detailed journey. We started with the immediate chaos of the shutdown ending in November 2025. And we've traced this path to a massive government-wide strategic realignment towards securitization by mid-2026. Can you just bring that whole trajectory together for us one last time?
Absolutely. The narrative arc is pretty clear now. We went from that very messy, politically charged moment, the 42-day shutdown, the painful compromise on ACA subsidies, into a period of remarkably fast, focused, and coherent action. The lame duck EO set a trap. The new AI governance EO set the direction. The AI Act locked it into law with huge funding. The Manila Compact extended the strategy globally. It all points to this central organizing principle, technological containment and national security as the prime directive.
And this pivot is reshaping everything.
Fundamentally, it's creating that two-track economy we discussed. It's reorganizing federal agencies around security missions. It's changing the entire landscape for tech innovation in the U.S., pushing towards consolidation and national champions. It's a profound shift.
Before we wrap up, let's just touch on one more human element. We've talked about the focus on defense systems, but what about the families supporting that system, military families and something like fertility care?
Yeah, it's a really poignant contrast. Despite pouring hundreds of billions into defense hardware and AI, there are still these gaps in supporting the actual people. Fertility treatment is a prime example. TRICARE, the military health insurance, it covers diagnosing infertility pretty well.
But not the treatments themselves, like IVF.
Generally, no. Things like IVF, artificial insemination, active duty families usually have to pay for those out of pocket. We're talking thousands, maybe tens of thousands of dollars. There are some very narrow exceptions, like if a procedure is done at a military hospital for training purposes, but those are rare and geographically limited.
So a family dealing with deployment stress, constant moves, is also facing this massive financial burden just to try and start a family.
Exactly. It's a huge stressor and a financial barrier that civilian families with good private insurance might not face to the same degree. It highlights this tension. Massive investment in the system of defense, but sometimes lagging support for the individual service members and their families who make the system work.
A stark contrast indeed. Okay, that brings us to our final thought. We've talked a lot about AI, data collection, security. You mentioned a warning from Chris Steierwalt about where this might lead for civil society.
Yeah, Steyerwald's point is pretty chilling, and it builds directly on this trend of massive data aggregation and analysis. He warns that as data mining gets more sophisticated, and as government and private entities build ever more comprehensive files on citizens combining financial, health, legal, social media data, we're rapidly approaching a point.
A point where?
Where it might become possible for almost anyone, corporations, political campaigns, maybe even individuals, to know the likely political leaning, the political score of almost any other citizen with a high degree of accuracy.
Wow. Just based on analyzing readily available data.
Exactly. The cost of doing that kind of detailed profiling is plummeting thanks to AI. Think about the implications. If your likely partisanship, your susceptibility to certain messages is easily knowable, how does that affect job interviews? Loan applications, even just how people interact with each other. Steyerwald asks us to consider the ultimate cost to privacy, to political freedom, to the very fabric of civil society as we embrace this new era of pervasive data collection and analysis in the name of security.
A deeply unsettling question to end on. What is the price we're willing to pay for this new security paradigm? Sam, thank you so much for walking us through all this complexity today. It's been a real deep dive.
My pleasure, Alex. It's a crucial moment and definitely a lot to unpack. Glad we could cover it.